LNE Volume 3, a video by the great Franklin Carbonati, spanning Rome, Milan, London, New York, Paris, Barcelona, Montreal, and Toronto, featuring Rebo, Volvo, Snens, MTNW, Anger, Talker, Xavier, BO South, Lure, Rehab, Time, Zonic, XSM, Kemto, Salon, TD, Emno, Fayer, Toser, Nove, Stays, Villo, OSF, Waste, Soul, Zano, Guko, and What. The full video is now available on our Patreon. Enjoy, peace, love, and respect. All right, Gory, what is up?
Nice to meet you, man.
Yeah. Nice to have you out here, man.
Thank you so much for coming here. We really appreciate it.
Thanks
We've
for
been
having
wanting
me.
To. I'm hyped that this is happening and stuff, you know? Especially with the rain and everything. Yeah. I was like, damn, I don't know how he's getting here or anything like that. I get worried. But so you're originally from Paris, right?
Yep. Born and raised in Paris.
How did you end up in New York? Was it always your dream as like a young graffiti writer in Paris to come to the Mecca where you see all these writers on the... Well, maybe there wasn't internet graffiti back then, but...
Definitely not.
You know, like nowadays, everyone sees everything with Carnage and all these websites of everything that's going on here.
Yeah.
And they want to come here. What was your experience like?
So we'll have to rewind a couple of decades ago. I'm not at all, but it was definitely before the internet days. I mean, the layout and foundation of the culture that we take part of probably started with Subway Art. As soon as Subway Art was published and distributed around the world, you know, like this phenomenon started everywhere. And of course, it made us all look back to New York. So that was definitely one of my main motivation. Around 2000, like early 2000, I came for the first time to visit a friend of mine who moved to New York. I stayed 2 weeks and I met a girl, and the rest is history, because that was 20 years ago, and we're married and we have two kids. So that's my New York story in a nutshell.
So that's interesting. So although there wasn't Instagram and YouTube videos, there was like a type of media that brought your attention to it.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, what's very interesting to me with graffiti is that at the moment we're speaking, there might be a kid in Kabul that's picking up a spray can and starting his first version of what we call graffiti. You know, the act of writing on the wall defines it as graffiti. So whatever he's doing, however he's doing it, just the fact that he's doing it makes it graffiti, you know. We all have our own different definitions, sort of. There's a few documents that are exchanged and that are passed around that anchor it back to a city, anchor it back to a certain practice, a certain way of doing it, and it becomes style writing, it becomes the culture that we're part of, and I don't know if that answers the question, mm-hmm. but...
Yeah,
this is the thing that I see with graffiti, you know.
Do you distinguish between what Nove calls writing on walls and objects versus everyday graff? You're talking about the kid in a different country picking up a can and it's graff because he's painting on a wall. But do you make a distinguishing point between them? Is there a separation for you?
Well, I like to talk about style writing and to take like Nove semantics, writing on objects, you know, like the Wawa thing that he talks about,
mm-hmm.
Happens for so many reasons every day, and it has been happening forever. You know, we take it to a different level where we really try to build up on a culture of penmanship and style writing. Everything to me starts with the tag, because that's how you start and that's the foundation. I almost see the tag as a skeleton on which you can attach things to make it thicker, to make it maybe more alive, and to build up different forms from it, whether it be a throw up, a piece, or anything, you know.
That's interesting, man. The idea of the tag as a skeleton, because your tag is it's very different from the majority of people, at least in New York and in America as I see it. Before you came here, I was lurking online on, you know, Hand Selecta or Carnage and some of the stuff you're doing where you do the top half is one line, the bottom half is one line, and then using the negative space, it would form the word that you wanted to say. And then also I was seeing an outline you did and it was like the top of the E didn't have an outline. So you're using the negative space to imply where the E has its boundary. And how do you think of this stuff?
Well, I feel that, in order to get good at writing, you have to practice a lot. Practice makes perfect. That's like one of the lines of Hansel Lecter. The more you do it, the more you fall into like muscle memory, into a reflex, into something that you have. You can do like second nature without really looking, so you can be like aware of your surroundings. And once you establish that, and once it becomes sort of like a stamp or a logo, it feels a little repetitive to always step in the same footpath, you know. So it's nice sometimes to go outside of the boundaries that you've created and outside of that muscle memory. So for example, if you're really used to start your letter from the top, I strongly encourage that you start it from the bottom, just to get a different link from that, just to get a different motion, just to get a different interaction with the letter, and kind of like reinventing that solid form that you've established to begin with.
Coming from Paris, what was the progression of your tag in particular? Because I've been to Europe, and in a way they don't really favor the tags in terms of like New York has a very distinct style of, you know, tagging. And I feel like looking at your tags right now, me personally, I would think you were from New York, you know. So how would you how was the progression? Was it like that from the beginning, or you kind of started meeting writers from New York, seeing the styles, and it kind of just flowed into a New York style? How was that?
Well, so to go back to like my personal evolution, I think when I, and it's funny because it really makes sense in terms of words in English, but when I turned from the age of, when I was born until the age of 12, I was a good kid. I was listening to everything. You could put me somewhere and say, we're going to go there. You stay here. I would stay at my spot, you know. And then when I turned 13, so when I came in teenagers, I probably started to like define myself a little more affirmatively and in deference to my environment and everything that was around me. Graffiti seemed to be like such a fun outlet, you know, like it was to, I took it from the start almost as a vector to meet like-minded people. The first thing you ask when you're 13 and you meet someone who's got paint on his clothes is, yo, what you write? And then my second question would be like, what's your name? Trying to be like maybe more personal and have a link. So to go back to your question about style, from 13, I would say around like till I was 17, my shit was really whack. And it's the beauty of graffiti too, you know, like we're all coming to the same wall, whether you're a king or whether you're a super tall, you know, like we're all going to be on the same surface, and there's not that many art form that can allow that. Maybe in music, when you do a jam, you know, you can have like a super performer. That's, we have an extra guest. No, it's all good. Love cats. So maybe in music, when you jam, you know, like you can have like a very established band, you know, that's going to take a kid on stage, and maybe the kid's going to be phenomenal. Maybe it's going to be whack. In graffiti, even though we censor each other and we tell you when you're whack, you know, like you're still on the same wall and we're still doing the thing together. So up until 17, I was polluting my environment, trying to understand what was style and how it works. Back then, there was absolutely no commercial aspect of graffiti. You had to rack your markers, make your own fucking ink. It was difficult to rack paint, so I was probably just more tagging because of that, you know, and little by little, things established themselves. But again, to go back to style, Paris has its own style writing culture. There's the same like foundations that are very, what we could call classic graffiti, you know, have happened pretty much everywhere, because the first dudes that were taking it at heart and putting a lot of work were usually really serious about it. And because they were like one in a million doing it, you know, like the information that they could gather was circulating in a different way. Europe was very particular in that sense, because there was a crew, Crime Time Kings, that was on several capitals that sort of like established what is classical graffiti writing. And you can see probably more the affirmation of that style in their pieces than in their tags, but their tags were as strong and as beautiful. And so that was like the foundation, you know. And from that, opening my eyes, traveling, meeting people, I was fortunate enough in 97, 98 to be part of a crew that sort of had a foot in the States, that's called FMK. And Diego had studied in the States and had brought back, I don't know, like things done by Tommy Rebel, things done by Casey in Chicago, like many different little influences like that, that definitely created a path for style writing into the New York culture.
So on Europe, you know how in New York, before it was the goal was to be on every train, to be all city meant to be on every train heavy. And now being all city means being on every borough heavy, mm-hmm. you know. And I know in Europe they have a really interconnected public transportation or whatever it is that you can take the train from Italy to here to mm-hmm. there to there. Is there kind of a similar thing there where writers from Italy try to be up in London and writers from London try to be up in Barcelona and Paris and they're all trying to do that or no?
So to like sort of lay out a map, I want to say like the 90s in Paris were explosive. There was tons of graffiti that was made, but pretty much everyone has had his own turf. You know, there was dudes already, even from the first generation that I talked about before, you know, that went all over the place. But as the general visual aspect of the city started to like change and become like overflowed with graffiti, you know, like there wasn't really one person that stood out and took on himself to be like, all right, I'm gonna be everywhere. Up until My Boy O'Clock came around and started to like really, really do a lot of damage in Paris. There was a point that anytime I would talk to someone who would know that I write graffiti, but someone that was outside of the graffiti world would tell me, I think that guy O'Clock is friend with you, right? And I'm like, yeah, I think he lives in my street. Because like 2 weeks ago, I saw like 5 red tags and now I see blue ones. And there was really a point that he smashed everything. Then as like to go back to your question, this idea of linking all the capitals of Europe together and all that to me stems more from the clean train movement where you have systems that belong to each country. So when you're in France, you have a train system that's French. And when you cross the border and you go to Italy, sometimes they make you change train to go to an Italian train. Sometimes you have a train from Italy that goes all the way to Paris. But it's a different system. So when you buy a ticket, you're buying a ticket in France and then you have to buy a ticket in Italy. You can buy one ticket in France that allow you to go to Italy, but just to give you an idea that it's a different system. They created a thing, all the train companies gathered together and said, it'd be great in the great spirit of Europe if we could propose one ticket for someone to travel, let's say for 2 weeks all across Europe. And of course, as soon as this started, clever little graffiti writers with a Photoshop and a printer were able to forge European tickets mm-hmm. that would give you the right to travel for a full month anywhere you please, you know. Mm-hmm. So it became a really strong incentive, I want to say like mid-90s, to go more towards the Eastern countries that didn't have that much graffiti, didn't have prevention around trains, and didn't have like a strong police force maybe, you know, like the Eastern Bloc falling down kind of helped that sort of mentality. But it really stemmed from the clean train generation, like from the dudes that were going after trains. And of course, when they would visit the cities, they would leave marks in the cities. And anywhere you go in Europe, you can, I mean, Amsterdam, for example, always was a strong traveling point because of how the drugs, the prostitution and everything is out in the open there. So everybody from the States or from Europe likes to take a trip in Amsterdam. And I think the first time I went in like 97, there was already like my 10 favorite people from Paris had smashed the city.
Really?
And you could see these guys from London, you could see these guys from somewhere else, you know.
How does the police force in Paris work in terms of how they approach capturing or arresting graffiti writers? Because I went to Paris, I've been there, I love Paris. I've been there a number of times, like a few years ago, I would try to go every summer. But I haven't been in like 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I would see all the writers out there. And when I went the first time, a few writers really stood out to me. One of them was he just did a G and a K on a sticker.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe it was the neighborhood I was in. I don't know. I feel like I went around, but he was crazy up with stickers. Similar to, you know, like the highest sticker writers you'd see in New York who have stickers everywhere. He had them everywhere. And then, also, I really enjoyed seeing Sizer's hands, and then I came back and I didn't see any Sizer here for a while, and then one day I just started seeing it up. I'm like, yo, I saw this guy a few years ago, and then who else? Stays. I saw mm-hmm. Stays up a lot the first time I went. Then the second time, I don't know if the buff happened. I don't know if he chilled out, but I didn't see him as much. But yeah, so getting back to my question is how does the police force nab writers there?
So it's interesting because I feel like it goes in waves. in terms of like enforcing prevention and trying to like basically give a swift kick in the end pile, you know. There's a first, like to me, the most interesting story was, I believe in 91, when three dudes went in the train station that's just below the Louvre, the big museum in Paris, you know, like the equivalent of your Met. Let's say you had a train station under the Met with replicas from like sarcophages in Egypt and old hieroglyphs and old scriptures that to the common passerby, when you're in that train station, you're looking at the sarcophagus, you feel like it's the real deal, you know?
Yeah.
So those three dudes in 91 went in that station at night and smashed, like literally destroyed the station. Next day, of course, 1 p.m., you know, like the news flash is starting and everywhere in France, all the journalists are only talking about that. For a full week, it goes on and on. They start a whole promotion campaign saying graffiti costs millions and we need to eradicate it. I believe that what happened at the time is that the task force that was put in place was a special unit reserved to dismantle terrorism at the border of France and Spain, because there were some activists, there's a whole region there that want to separate and want to have their independence, and they were doing some pretty nasty bombings, like I don't know, killing cops and doing things like that. That unit was very successful. They put a bunch of bad people. They put a bunch of very convinced people in jail. Mm-hmm. And then when they were done with their assignment, they had a new assignment, was to arrest three teenagers that probably were walking around with paint on their hands and maybe a plate on their belt, you know, saying their name, like something pretty ridiculous when you come from that type of prevention. But it worked, and it proved them, you know, that if you really put the means behind it, it's really not that hard to catch a bunch of teenagers. And so that's why I say it comes in waves, because we had the same thing happening. It was more directed toward the Clean Train movement, but in 2002, I want to say like over 50 people got raided within the course of 3 or 4 weeks.
Wow.
So this is like on the side of police. And because you were talking about the buff, for different various reasons, might it be the Olympics, might it be the new millennium coming or whatever, you know, like they always find a reason to... We're going to take this area that has like a bunch of old houses, and we're going to build a nice fancy stadium so we can host like big sports event. And also we're going to clean all the graffiti that's around it and maybe the entire city, because it looks better when everything is beige and gray.
Yeah. I see a lot of people, they when they speak about France, they relate it to New York in a way of painting, because they see how fun it is, how active it is, and they relate the city itself to New York. I never been there, but anybody that I hear talk about Paris, they say it's almost funner to paint there. Why do you think that is so? Like, speaking of the cops and stuff, do you feel like it's like a less cop presence, or it's what do you think? Why is the graffiti scene so popping over there?
Yeah, there's it comes from so many different places. There's a very strong cultural prism around the idea of freedom in this country. In the States. And it's something that's always put forward, you know, like it's a very, very big word. People are passionate about that word and all that, you know, but anybody that I know from New York that has traveled in Paris will hands down tell you, like, this was a mind-bugging trip, you know, like, without getting too deep into politics, you know, like the simple fact that you can be a functioning member of society, paying taxes, raising kids, maybe you're a teacher, maybe you're, I don't know, like maybe you have your own company and you're like making, you know, like you're a good force in this whole equation. The fact that when you're done with work, you can't go to the bodega, buy a beer, open it and drink it in the street on a bench, to me is completely preposterous, you know. So the idea of like this prism of freedom, you know, that's very dear to a lot of people in this country, it's kind of like shift on its head when you go to Paris or when you go outside of the United States. And I want to put a disclaimer out here. I'm not trying to make a level of comparison, you know. I'm not born here. I'm French. I have French blood in my veins. It's been long enough that I'm in New York that I call this place home. I don't consider myself a New Yorker because I think it's borrowing things that don't belong to me, you know. Mm-hmm. But anybody that traveled in Paris realized that it's not necessarily something that people want to hang in front of themselves saying like we're free, you know. Mm-hmm. But it's part of your daily life, and it's something that you completely integrate as like a general feeling. And we could touch, I said, I don't want to dive into politics, but we could touch like other points, like the idea of universal healthcare and things like mm-hmm. that are way more serious, you know. But I find ways to attach them to that idea of simple, basic human rights that are part of that freedom, you know.
Yeah, I've noticed that in Germany because I have relatives out there in a small town called Zennestadt. It's not far from Dusseldorf, you mm-hmm. know, the airport. And I noticed the same thing. Like, there's not tension in the people there, you know. It's when I went there, people were just in the morning, a random stranger approaching me and saying, "Hello, how are you?" with a genuine smile on their face. And I was like, what do you want from me? You want money? Like, you know, it's like in New York, this mentality is like, why would anybody talk to me, you know? And I noticed the same thing, like construction workers, for example, after work, they would gather in the park and like just hang out, just talk, you know, not being like belligerent, you know, just drinking and having a good time, you know. And I just noticed the people there were also very easygoing, you know. And then coming back to New York, I remember I was walking down the street and I would look at a person, like, say hello, and they would look at me like I'm like a mental patient, you know.
What's wrong with
you? It's not a normal thing, you know. And I think it's something we should aspire, you know, take on those qualities. I think it's very important.
Yeah. So because I've been a lot in that situation where you're the other, you know, like when I came to the States, I am the other. And now that I've been living here long enough, when I go back to France, I'm not completely like the same person that I was before, you know? So I feel that what you're talking about is more a point of observation and this idea of exotism. One thing that I would say from my first like 2 weeks in New York is that anywhere I was, if I would start to look at a map, like for example, I'm on a platform, I look at a map, it would be like, it would not be rare that someone would come to me and be like, "Hey, are you lost? Can I help you?" You know? Mm-hmm. So I think when you come, maybe it's your demeanor, maybe it's because you're fresh coming off the boat, yeah. you know, and people might see that vulnerability, or you just might have been lucky and find someone who was in a good mood that yeah, day, you know, yeah. which happens too. But it's hard to really look at an experience that you have when you're like taking it in a small amount of time like that, and when you're coming just for a couple of days, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, they say that the eye chooses what it chooses to see, and I think that when you know there is a common idea of America as a place of anger and aggression, and then there is that common idea amongst many Americans or people who live here. So those moments will really, they'll be like emphasized to you when they do occur, and they could shun out all the moments where it was either positive or neutral. And then you'll be thinking that. And something that you said that you were talking about how they have universal basic income, I mean, basic healthcare
mm-hmm.
in France or in Europe in general.
Yeah, and in the world in general.
Yeah, in the world in general. Isn't America's like the only developed country that doesn't have it?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's like this idea that like, oh, if the government can make us pay extra taxes for our healthcare, then they're in control of where we spend our money, which equates to a lack of freedom. This is the idea that politicians use to go against socialism.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it's just interesting, like the different perspectives of what freedom is. You're saying how in France, like the freedom that they have, because everyone has some sort of freedom. So the freedom, the type that they have is kind of like intrinsic in their daily life. So they don't think about it. It's not something that's continuously spoken of, like land of the free, 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 free,
exactly.
free. It's just something that is in the background almost. It's like, I breathe oxygen. I don't need to say it every second that I breathe oxygen.
Oxygen is free.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
For now.
Yeah, for now,
But exactly. You say, this brings me to my other point, is that you said that when you first started writing, one of the main points was to evade arrest. That was one of your main points, and that you were afraid of the police when you first started writing. However old you were when you first started writing, what brought about that fear of police? Because, you know, not everyone has like a fear so great of police that their main point of above everything is to evade arrest number one. You know what I mean?
I don't know. Maybe I got really unlucky, but me and my friends, when we started to write graffiti, like I said, at 13, 14, you know, like, like a few of my friends got arrested. I got chased pretty badly. And again, like, I don't want to focus on the negative, because at the end of the day, I got chased, but I got away.
Mm-hmm.
The one story that I'm thinking of is actually pretty funny. I think at the age of like, 14, I woke up really late on a Sunday night, like around 3:30. I was, my bedroom was next to the apartment door, and I could hear my dad snoring in the back. So I came next to the door, put the key in, opened it, and every time the snore was like diminishing, I would stop in my tracks and all that. I escaped in the middle of the night, which for a 14, 15-year-old was completely insane. And I went around my school to write my name, to just the next day being able to be like, hey, guys, this is me in the red can here. And of course, because I was an idiot, I got chased and I got away with it. But I guess like maybe my first, like the first experiences you have, you know, like the first couple months that you're diving into it are probably formative. And I guess I'm from an older generation where when people would get caught, they would change name. They would reinvent their identity in a way. Mm-hmm. We were a lot more paranoid because we didn't have really any idea of what were the strong consequences. We knew there was consequences, but there was no like strong cases made against graffiti or anything like that. It was almost like this chivalresque idea that mm-hmm. if you're doing it, not getting caught is completely part of it. You know, it has to be part of the equation. Otherwise, you're just gonna end pretty quick for you. You know,
mm-hmm. So. You did get caught in the beginning, right? And you quit because of it.
No, it's funny you said that I said that because I don't remember saying.
I could have sworn.
Yeah,
you said that, right?
I said that. Okay.
In a short video. Yeah.
I think that you said.
Oh,
that
in a video.
A short video.
Oh, okay. Okay. I thought it was right now. So.
No, you either got caught in the beginning, and that made you quit because you had like an.
True. So I was
friends talking about you to like on the birthday or something.
Yeah, exactly. And, I was referring to. I think the question to. The question that led to those answers was where does your name come from? Mm. And so I'm going back a couple steps, but the idea was that those first like 4 years approximately, you know, of like being really bad at graffiti and mainly just catching tags, doing like one-liner throw-ups and stuff like that. I was drawing a lot, you know, but I was just not really there. And those first few years ended up with me not being super happy about graffiti and what it was bringing to my life. So I kind of like put it to the side, you know, and I still had friends because like I said, I was trying to get personal and realized that another dude the same age as me or a year older or a year younger, you know, could be potentially a friend. So I kept in contact with all those dudes, and one day they came to me and they were like, yo, it's Matt's birthday. We're going to go like paint, you know, like this chill spot on the other side of the river. And I grabbed a piece of paper off my desk, and there was a gory on it. Like there was different names, but there was a gory, and that's kind of how it started. But it came from like the first few years where I was really bad. I had like a very hip hop serious name with an R and a K in it. I was writing E-R-A-K, Iraq 2, mm-hmm. Which sounded like really really bad, you know. And gory in French is like kind of like a familiar name that you give to a kid when he acts like a slob. Mm-hmm. So I thought it was sort of a mockery of the whole seriousness of it, you know, and the idea that you could get caught and all that, you know. I wanted to be like more, not as engaged and more light about it. And it stuck, you know, like that, mm-hmm. that one experience of painting with my friends was like, wow, this is really great. I should still be doing this, you know.
When did you... What brought about the stop? Because, you know, like you said, you don't paint at night anymore. Or you're not out.
Oh, now years have gone by. So when I moved to New York in 2007, I really wanted to start over in a way, you know, coming to a new country, discovering a new culture. All those like different aspects of my life were coming to a point where I consciously made the choice of not focusing entirely on graffiti. I was still walking around with a marker in my pocket, and I was still catching tags left and right. I was still completely in love with it, but for all the reasons that I've evoked, you know, I was really trying to focus on different things. And even doing it at such a very like diligent pace, you know, I still ended up in bookings one night. I got caught smoking pot in the street in the same year. Like a bunch of stuff happened like that. And I realized, you know, like kind of like what we were saying before, you know, about drinking a beer in the street. Like there's things you can do and things you cannot do. And if I really wanted to like dedicate myself and be still the same guy, it would have definitely been possible. But at the time, I made a different choice. And I focused more on my career, getting a job and getting established, which sounds like old.
Mm-hmm. Like, how did you get known in New York? Because it seems to me like when you came here, like you said, you made a conscious decision to not make graffiti your main point, to not be, you know, out there like scoping spots, painting for 6 hours a night, blah, blah, blah. But yet everybody in New York knows about Gory. Everybody in New York knows your hand style. How did this happen?
Well, so during the first year, it really wasn't my point of focus, but I was still, like, my boy O'Clock came to New York a bunch of times. He was here mainly, at first, he just wanted to do the streets, but then he got really, really interested in the train system. Mm. And I was walking with him, doing homework and like, spotting spots when I had free time, you know, but I wasn't going in the yard with him just for the reasons that I told you, you know. And I still was around. I was still catching tags left and right and still doing things. And also, like, it's funny because it links back to that idea of exotism and how fresh you are when you come, you know. Anytime I was here for like a week or so, I was doing what I was doing in Paris, you know, like walking around with a marker. You look left, you look right, you catch a tag. You go out at night, you take two cans with you, you do a little throw up here, it goes fast, nobody sees anything, in 5 minutes you're done, you know. But doing this consistently, like maybe like once or twice a year, allowed me within the years to be sort of like part of the landscape, you know. And it's funny because it's not necessarily through connections and linking, because when I was here for 5 days, we were traveling to my in-laws, we were visiting left and right, you know, and it's not like I was here for 5 days of graffiti in New York either, you know. But I was able to maintain that sort of like little sprinkle of Gory soldiers in the city a little bit.
I see. So basically, every time I go to Paris and I look around, I get really, I wouldn't say overwhelmed, but just impressed with how beautiful the city is. It's a very artistic city from the architecture. The architecture just triumphs over what we have here. Here, to me, it seems more about just brute force functionality. So how many people can fit in this rectangle?
Mm-hmm.
But over there, maybe it's because it's from a different era and the buildings are older, but everything is a sculpture. Everything's a sculpture. How the city is laid out here, it's a grid. Like I said, like brute force functionality there. It's just crazy. Do you think that that's influenced the way your graph is? Because your graph is some people's throwy per se, or their hand style is just, you know, maybe it's influenced by the place they come from. Just boom, get it done, boom.
Mm-hmm.
Yours has extra thought to it. Yours has, there's so much that goes into just one of your tags or one of your throwies that it makes me question if growing up in an artistic city that played a part in it. Did you go, for example, to the museums like the Louvre? That place is huge. I've been there, like I said, 3 times. I don't think I've seen the whole thing. Because I'm like, yo, I'm over it. And then I leave and it's just too much.
Yeah.
Did you used to go there and look at stuff, get influenced? And
so, I mean, I've always had a passion for art and always had a strong curiosity for it. The Louvre was the most boring thing as a kid. I mean, if you take, and it's mind-bugglingly huge, full of history and kind of like dusty at times. So it's three things that you really don't want to be faced with when you're younger. Mm-hmm. It took me years actually to go to that place and really enjoy it. One interesting thing, you know, when you're putting in like looking at Paris and looking at New York, I read not long ago that the city of Rome has been trying to build an extra line of subway, and they started 40 years ago. And the reason of that is that every time they're digging a little further in the tunnel, they're finding a new archaeological site. And in 40 years, they've discovered like three main things that are like bigger than almost like bigger than the Colosseum, you know, like things that were already in place and were getting degraded by the elements because they were outside, you know, like they're digging and they're like, oh my God, history is like just under us, you know. The reason why we can put the two examples that you gave, you know, against one another is because only because of history, you know, like Paris was built, like it's over a 2,000-year-old city that started with a little island in the middle and there was a bunch of swamp and little by little they were able to like enlarge the city, and you have you have almost like different rings like that that are telling the history of the city and the complexity of the maze of the street and even the quality of the street that you're stepping on when it's those brick blocks, you know, those rock blocks. You can tell like this must be really old. And you look at the architecture around you. If you look at a house that's a little crooked and you see a lot of wood on either on the outside or from the ceiling, you can tell like this is probably like a couple century old. When you go back to 200 years in Manhattan, you have like maybe the sort of a shape of a kind of a park and downtown a bunch of streets, you know, but 200 years ago, it was pretty bare and starting, you know. So, and to go back to your question, you're constantly influenced by your environment. You're constantly influenced by your experiences. When you're surrounded, I guess, by those, it's not something that's a conscious choice. It's not something that you necessarily see, you know, but you're surrounded by sculptural works of architecture and you like the subway entrances designed by Hector Guimard. You have like all those like mundane things that are part of your daily life, you know, where when you take a step back and you look at it, you realize the beauty of it. And even if it's maybe more artistic and embedded with history and with like quintessential, almost like statement pieces that you can find almost at every corner, I believe there's beauty in everything, you know, and the grid that you talked about, the like deafening echo of a fire truck passing by you on an avenue with big fucking buildings around, it's an experience too, you know, that's beautiful in itself. It might be a little scary at times. It might not stem from the same sort of poetic environment, but it still is. There's still beauty in that, you know. And because you're influenced by your environment, it definitely projects a different aspect of what you can do, you know, as an expression, as a form.
Yeah, I try to think about things from a third person perspective sometimes. Just take myself, like detach myself from my physical body and look at the situation from where I am. So. It was funny because one time I was on the subway in Paris. I think it was the first time I went there, and we were riding around. And you know, in New York, the Statue of Liberty is so far away from everything. You can't just when the train turns a corner, it's not right in front of your face. Mm-hmm. And I was in Paris, and we turned the corner, and it was pretty much that thing with the Eiffel Tower was right in front of my face. That was the first time I saw. I was like, what? And then. I'm like, I wish there was cool things like that in New York. You know, like that's the mindset in the exact moment. Mm-hmm. And then I was taking the train to South Brooklyn a few months ago alone. And I was on a train line that I never take, which is the N line all the way through from Queens to South Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. And we passed by the from Manhattan to Brooklyn, the river. And it was nighttime and I saw a bunch of fill-ins, you know, on the thing. And I saw it looked so beautiful. And I realized if I was from Paris... And I was here at this moment, I'd be like, yo, look at those brick buildings. Those are like the ones in the Mobb Deep music videos. Oh, it's like Capone and Noriega. That's like the building they were all standing in front of for the war report. You know what I mean? Yep. I realized I would think those things. Wow, I don't know, like some New York writer, there's a fill-in right there. He's never in Paris. What the heck? Oh, Carnage took a picture of that. You know, you'd start thinking all of these things. And then, yeah, it's like... You don't realize what's right in front of your eyes. So maybe the people from Paris, they realize how beautiful it is, but not to the extent that maybe someone who never gets to go there goes there and they're like, what is this insanity?
Well, yeah, it's hard to get surprised by the mundane and by your like daily environment. But when you come to think about it, like I don't know, like just a simple nasty pigeon next to you, you can look at it as something that's like. Full of disease and horrible and might, like if it starts flying, I don't know if he can fly, but if he starts flying, he might shit on me, you know, so I don't want it near me. But you can also think about it as a human, like a sentient being that has the same pair of lungs that you have inside your body, mm-hmm. that doesn't have, or we don't really know, doesn't have as developed brain as we do, you know, but we don't really know that either. We're just taking it for granted, you know, but there's beauty in everything to that regard, you know, and of course I'm opposing architectural forms with sentient beings. So it's not really fair of a demonstration, but it is like you can surprise yourself. One thing that we do as graffiti writers is that we're always like analyzing the environment, looking, maybe you can call it looking for spots, but it might be just out of curiosity and the way the eye is trained to not just be on the street level of things, you know, but to look up. And I believe that any complex developed city has a story to tell with the rooftops, you know. And there's always surprising things when you look up, because it's not necessarily the showboat piece that the architect is going to think about. Maybe at a time it was, because they wanted people to be like to look in marvel, you know, to be like, oh my god, they put some sculptures on the 12th floor of that skyscraper back then, you know.
Yeah.
If you put yourself in the position, like you said, you call it the third person, but you put yourself in a position to be surprised, I believe there's beauty everywhere.
Yeah, and the thing that you do, which is, you know, you go on the train and you draw people. You take a bunch of architecture that you see, and then you smash it into one thing of architecture. And what I've found is that whenever I draw or I paint, I've never done architecture like that, but like portraits, you start to see the beauty in things that you didn't see before. Even someone who might be regarded as ugly, you see their nose and you see how their features, and if you were to, you have to really focus in on it to paint it and to draw. And I can imagine that doing that in terms of architecture and smashing all these things together, almost making like a microcosm of New York, because it's so much like insanity going down in one place. There's no space to breathe, you know. There's like window here, clothesline here, washing machine falling out of the window over there. You start to appreciate the beauty in it because you're paying very close attention and seeing it almost for what it is, as opposed to what you think it is and what your eye is making you see.
Yeah,
you know,
no, I agree with what you're saying, honestly, because it's very important to slow down time and appreciate the little things, I think. Because we were walking around, I remember, in Flushing not too long ago, and you know, you can just keep, you know, in your daily routine, you can walk by a certain house or a certain block every day and not realize, you know, what's around you, because you're worried always about getting to your destination. But I remember pointed out, like two blocks away, there was someone had a garden in the front of their house, and it's like this beautiful tree and the little garden with the tiles they put down, a little maybe bonsai tree, and just like little things that you know, mindlessly can walk by. But if you appreciate, it takes a lot of value, you know. And I was going to ask about what Angel was saying about the architecture that you draw, the watercolors.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering it goes back to like appreciating the little things, because I seen one you did, for example, in Chinatown, where you would walk around and photograph them, and later on put those sculptures, the architecture together,
mm-hmm.
you know, and like a regular New Yorker walking through Chinatown, they just want to get past the stampede of people, you know, they don't really care. But you were appreciating you were realizing that the signs were all yellow, and you found that so interesting. And then when you do see what you painted, the watercolors, the details you put in are so amazing. Like, how did you start watercoloring? How did that come about?
To go back to what Angel was saying, and it links to your question, that intrication that you see in New York is prevalent anywhere in the world. You know, like I haven't been to Africa, but I know there's a lot of DIY and there's a lot of stacking up going on.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't traveled a lot to Asia, but I know it's prevalent there too, you know. And the cramming a lot of people in a very small place happens everywhere in the world, and mm-hmm. tends to elevate. Instead of being horizontal, we become vertical. Unless we do it with machines and concrete and rebars and make it like very boring and straight, you know, it's going to be a treehouse. It's going to be built on top of each other. And it's going to become, in my eyes, it's going to become an incredible source of inspiration. And the watercolors, trying to go back to your question, Z, it's funny because, I find that I have a hard time doing the same thing over and over, except for graffiti, maybe. But like my like commercial career, you know, has always been, it's almost like I take a 2-year trip on a new lane, and I exploit it and I learn and I'm happy with it. And then 2 years later, I'm somewhere else. So watercolor was sort of a, I don't want to say a challenge, but it was very interesting to me that I was able to have this practice going on, almost as a red line, you know, guiding me throughout the years. Because I started over 12 years ago now. I did my first like stacked environment, and It was during a show in New York in 2008 that was called Home for the Holidays, and that was put by Klughaus. Mm. And the reaction and the reception for the three pieces that I put, you know, really gave me an incentive to be focused on it and devote time and try to really build on it. And yeah, now it's been 12 years that I'm still doing them. It's hard to carve time for them, and this year has been really super challenging, especially for parents. I mean, for everyone, but especially for parents with kids. But it's something that I try to nourish and try to build upon, and that I hope I'll keep going.
When did you realize you had this artistic talent? Because not everyone can just, you know, sit down and create such quality. You know, that's the standards you're at is like, I feel like it's a different level that maybe a normal person just out of nowhere, you know.
I appreciate your point of view. There's a saying in French that maybe exists in English, that I was born with a pencil, you know, like it was some sort of like a second nature. It was part of like some kids are going to play with blocks and some kids are going to play with crayons and a dry erase board for hours. You know, I was more the later. And I've always tried to express myself through the medium of drawing. And I've always, like, I guess I was pretty bad at school for that reason. You know, I was really not interested in learning science, physics, history or geography, but really just drawing.
Mm-hmm. When you first started painting graffiti in Paris, were you doing it as a sense of maybe rebellion? Did you feel like you were being, in a sense, chained down by whether it be people's expectations of you or society or the rules that are all in place, and you just want to, you know what I'm saying? Like, you mm-hmm. just want to do something crazy. Was that part of the reason? Is that the kind of mentality that there was?
I mean, there was, just because of the age that I was, but we like to joke with a few friends of mine in Paris that graffiti was the last part of the Marshall Plan. The Marshall Plan was put in place after Second World War to economically help the Allies redevelop their countries, you know? And of course, it wasn't part of the Marshall Plan to have something like that, but at the center of it, to me, is the idea of pop culture in America. And I can't pinpoint exactly when it started, you know, but graffiti is definitely on that train. I think it's easier for anyone in the world today, when you're like 11, 12 or 15, it's easier to say, I love you, than to say, ich liebe dich or je t'aime or anything, you know. It's the songs that we've heard. It's the pop culture through clothing, through anything, you know. And I would lie if I would say it was just a rebellious thing, you know, like even if it was like maybe like the first official CDs with rap music on them, you know, were passed around. We were copying tapes. I was listening to Fear of a Black Planet, probably learn a good amount of English swear words through Flavor Flav and Chuck D. Mm-hmm. It felt rebellious because I was a teenager. It was going against the rock and roll prism of my parents and all that, you know. And it's also like, it's not like we're taking nice little sketchbook, just putting colors in them, you know. Like we like to leave marks around us. So mm-hmm. that act in itself is rebellious, but it was part of if I would have been maybe 10 years ahead in Paris, I would have definitely answered differently, you know. Just because it was like I cited that incident of the Louvre train station. Shout out to Chase, by the way, because when I told you about that story, you know, like it was on the news, like my parents were talking about it. It was known fact, you know, that graffiti was there.
I feel like Paris has a lot of similarities, like we were saying, to New York, because I know that the rap scene in France is the second largest in the world, just after the United States. Mm-hmm. And they make good stuff. I don't speak French, but you know, like, I listen to Supreme, NTM and all these other rappers, or even French trap music right now, and it's the beats and all of the stuff is very similar to America. It almost sounds like Supreme, NTM was like maybe the Mobb Deep or the Wu-Tang Clan of back then for Paris. And their music videos and their style of clothing. And I know skateboarding over there is huge. And mm-hmm. like when I go there, I skate Republic and all these spots. There's like, I don't know if it's an American influence, but it seems like there's like a, you know, because these things like skateboarding and graffiti and all these like rap music, it's widely an American it starts here. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Completely.
So do you think that, I don't know, like what I'm trying to say, if like the graffiti that comes from New York or the graffiti that comes from America, the underground, like, I guess, rebellious subcultures, like you said, it's not just coloring in a book. You're leaving marks everywhere you go. Mm. A big influence comes from America.
Oh, completely. And like, it's no one can deny that. And it's funny that you definitely did your homework, but it's funny that you would approach the NTM in France with like, let's say, a Wu-Tang Clan, because oddly enough, and it's kind of the same thing with the graffiti history, is that things almost evolve in parallel. There is definitely a lead, you know, coming from New York, but we're going back to a time where there was no international copyright laws. Mm-hmm. There was not that sort of like big, broad understanding of the everything at every time, you know. And things were created kind of in a vacuum. One person from Paris would go to New York and come back with like 10 mixtape. Mm-hmm. And maybe those 10 mixtape, which was, let's say, like a small percentage of the mixtape collection of one individual in New York, would become the foundation for hundreds of kids copying those tapes and passing them around, you know. Mm-hmm. So things could at time turn comical for that reason, you know. Like, if you would see one guy with his pants like all wrapped up all the way to his knee walking in a funny way, and you would see that and be like, oh, this is the shit, I have to bring it back to Paris. And all of a sudden everybody is doing that, you know. Out of context, things turn into like a mockery of themselves in a way. But I like the idea of considering them evolving in parallel. When NTM started, I don't think they of course had a direct knowledge of everything that was happening, but they were also much more rooted in being like their own individuals. Mm-hmm. And creating their own flavor through it, you know. One of the things that we lost, I believe, with that homogenization and the fact that mm-hmm. we know everything at all time, you know, is that there's no more incentive of developing a subgenre or being a subculture. Or maybe it exists, but it's more global, you know. Like, it's gonna be spread within individuals that are linked together, instead of being like a tight knit group of friends that are gonna develop their thing on their own, you know.
Yeah, it's gonna be interesting to see how, well, I'll probably be dead, but like how things are gonna play out throughout the years with all the cultures just becoming so interconnected. It just takes away the homogenous aspect of everything. Before, like you said, it was, cultures are pretty much developing in and of themselves. Mm-hmm. So even before like a photo log, or before the internet, imagine how they were. And then now, if someone's doing something in Paris, I'm going to find out about it fairly quickly. You know what I mean?
Well, sometimes I'm telling friends in Paris of something that happened because I've seen it online before they were aware of it. Mm-hmm. And same thing here, you know. This is how fast it goes today. If you're not on the right channel that's going to divulge the information at that moment, you're going to have the information first. And, you know, like, it's very interesting. I think one way to counter that maybe is to accept complexity and to, instead of making shortcuts and dumbing things down, you know, like, accept complexity and accept like very, I don't know, like, sometimes things that might look hard to understand, you know, being able to decipher them and break them down and understand mm-hmm. plenty of little parts.
I guess, like, to me, what I think of is, like, we say, oh, well, at least I say, I find myself saying, oh, it sucks that there's not going to be any separate cultures now. But then when I really think about it, I kind of think, why does it even matter? That was the thing of the past. People were, in a way, separated. The knowledge was separated. Now it's more united. It's easier to communicate. That's a thing in the past. Does it even matter? I don't know. But I was wondering, you grew up in Paris, and now you live in New York. You've been living here for a minute now. And do you ever plan on going back? Do you ever think or fantasize about going back or leaving New York in general?
It's a tough question. We're two making decisions in my life. With my wife and the kids, you know, and becoming a parent and working in New York and doing it for so many years, when you're not a New Yorker, it feels a little feels a little challenging to find the good reason and to always go back to the first love you had when you came here. You know, I'm still super thrilled to be here, but she's not so much, mm-hmm. for so many reasons. You know, and we're slowly working on a plan. We looked at Philly for a minute because it's conveniently very, very close from New York, and for the small nucleus of a family of four, it makes financially a lot more sense to be in a smaller city. But I don't know. Like we'll see. You know, like every day is a new adventure, and I like to keep it like that. But I like it here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting how the same place can be so different for so many different people. Because I like to ask that to people who come on the show, mm-hmm. if they want to move out. And I've heard the craziest, like, yes, as soon as I can, fuck this place. And then some people, like, I remember one that stands out to me is Lion saying his appreciation for this place and mm-hmm. how much it's given him and how much the opportunity he has and the events that can happen. And I remember I was on his Instagram and he posted, this was forever ago, it was like a meetup for all the low heads in Times Square, and mm-hmm. they were showing off their old jackets, and it was just everyone together having an event. And he said, it's reasons like this that I love New York, because things like this can happen. And, you know, when you go to other places that aren't major cities, you really realize that there is a benefit. You know, there's pros and cons to everywhere. That being said, if I saw a Gory hand style in Philly, if I went to Philly and I saw a Gory hand style, I would be very hyped. Yeah. I would take, I don't really take pictures of graph,
yeah,
but I would take a picture of it and post it on my story, because it would just be, that would be sick.
Well, so I'm gonna use this to build a bridge with the next story. But when I started to live in New York, work in New York, and try not to get in trouble with graffiti in New York, a few of my friends from Paris had link with artists in Philly. Mm. Philly is known for its number of murals, and one of our good friends there is named Paul Santoleri, and he has like. He's got a couple hundreds walls. Like he's really established as an artist, always evolving in parallel to mural art program. Sometimes joining them and sometimes not joining them. But around like 2010, we started to go with a few friends. You know, we started to go almost like every weekend, and the goal was just to gather with those mural painters and to do public art, like to paint walls. It's a practice and a mentality that made me discover applying paint on a wall in a total different light, and it was really, really refreshing. The idea was that, let's say, for example, Paul is the artist. He's got the location. He's doing the blueprint, and then we're coming to help to put some color on the wall, or even prime the wall, or put a varnish on the wall at the end. You know, the task was not necessarily associated with your level of skills. The persona and the ego was not involved in it, because it was a community program and it was community art. And also the message, even if it's just painting flowers, you know, like the message was at the center instead of having the name at the center of it. And it made me discover like a total different practice, which at the time I believed could only like happen in Philly because of the culture and the environment. Mm-hmm. And With Nov, we brought it back. Like we brought back that mentality to New York to do bigger walls, and we can talk about that.
Yeah, no, I was actually gonna talk about the mural. That that's how I met you, through the mural with Nov York. You know, and I just wanted you to explain what that was about. So it was in South Brooklyn off the F train, mm-hmm. and you know, it was an old school subway art theme, and said "Know Thyself." So how did that even come about? How do you connect with Nov? How do you guys, you know, what's the history behind this?
So Nov is one of the most interesting persona that I know. He's been traveling a lot and going to Paris, and it was almost like a Texavery, you know, at the end when the mouse is chased by the cat and they enter doors and all that. Anytime Nov would be in Paris, I'd be in New York, and we talked through email, but very briefly. But we never met in the flesh, you know. So when I moved to New York, all my friends in Paris that were good friends with him were like, oh, finally, you're going to meet this guy, because it never happened before. And we became friends, you know, just because of the connections we had, like the friends in common. And Nov is always the one, like when you ask me how did Know Thyself came about, Nov is always the one who's going to come with the content, and much more than that, but he's coming with the content. So he's, as with his position of being a writer and writing books and thinking about the grand scheme of things, you know, like he's always coming with very interesting ideas. The first one, which is like the foundation of this project that we're talking about, was to pay homage to the foundation of graffiti with the form of subway art, and to inject broader themes of general culture so that the conversation around those public art could be placed in a more broader way. So instead of just keeping it to ourselves and our culture, because the book really is about that, you know, our idea and our main goal was to be broader and to engage in a conversation through the form of public art. Another thing that we did was to take a step back from the usual painting a wall and signing it, you know, and we were taking the persona out of that equation, which reflects what I was talking about with Philly. And what I discovered at the time for the first wall that we did, the now famous in your podcast, Joan of Arc wall, shout out to Hurt and Kuma. But we gathered a bunch of friends. It was a total improvisation, you know, like some of us had a blueprint in head and some of us had sort of a map. We had the paint, we had everything. But it was very chaotic in the way we put it in place. There was no Excel chart exchange. There was no email to gather at 9:30 at that point and all that. Everything was like we do in graffiti, you know, like through word of mouth, through you calling a friend, I'm calling two friends. He's bringing a can of white and we're going to finish this thing and it's going to be great, you know. And at the end of the day, or at the end of the 2 days, when we're done with the painting, which you participated in one of the events, you know, you feel completely different than when you're doing your own thing and when you're walking that path that you occasionally know, you know. And it's super liberating, like to distance yourself, your own self, from the paint that you're putting on the wall and to take a step back and look at it. It really places, and I encourage everyone to try that, you know, it really places your relationship to what you created on a different level. And it's really interesting. It's broader. I feel like doing a segue to the beginning of the conversation. I'm not trying to compare and put two things against one another, you know, like on one hand, public art and painting walls, and on the other hand, graffiti and myself, you know. But it's just two very different things, and one is an outlet that is engaging in conversation and broader, and maybe shedding a more positive light on the whole thing, you know.
It's interesting how you say... with these murals, you disassociate your name with what you're putting on the wall. It's as if it's like for a bigger meaning, you know, a bigger picture, because that message is very powerful, you know, like know thyself, especially in that neighborhood, you know, because I'm from that neighborhood. It's it's almost like I feel like no one there really thinks like that in those, you know, that phrase in particular, you know. It's like everyone kind of just carries on with their day, and having that like light, you know, that know thyself, those colors, everything is like... It's like a spark we needed in that neighborhood. It's, you know, it's very powerful. And I think graffiti in a way is because a lot of people, they do graffiti because they want their name to be known. Mm-hmm. Just them, you know, they associate their graffiti with that name. So like you said, disassociating is it's like an ego death almost. Maybe, you know, it's for the grand scheme of things, you know, sending a message to the public.
Yeah.
You
know? And speaking of the public, there's an interaction that happened. And I'm going to make first a small parenthesis. We like to nickname Nov Stradamus, because he's always coming with those schemes, and it always comes for a reason, you know. Originally, we were talking about doing that wall in like September last year, and the month were rolling by, winter was setting in, and we're like, we can't really, like, we don't really know how to put a scaffolding together. Like, there's lots of things that are just part of the adventure, you know. We sort of have permission for it, but not really completely. We're always like threading the line, you know. The mural really, really should have happened in February. And imagine if we did the Know Thyself before the lockdown. Like, you do the wall and then people are stuck at home and we're exchanging pictures because we're trying to get busy at home, you know? And the Know Thyself message would have been so, so powerful back then. Regardless, it still is powerful. Now for the sort of like anecdote interaction. As you know, this area has a lot of Orthodox Jewish bakers that are doing like wonderful challah bread, but they're not necessarily the most welcoming people in terms of their interaction with the surroundings. And as we're painting the wall, I think we started on Shabbat, so there was absolutely nobody looking at us. And we thought, oh, this is great, you know, like we're maybe like 20 dudes on the rooftop. Some of us are just here to kick back, drink a beer. Some of us are painting. And it's a whole, it's a gathering, you know, more than anything else. The next day was less dynamic in terms of participation, but we were still there, you know, and all of a sudden we see from the next rooftop, from that bakery, you know, like one person come out and then two, three, and all of a sudden they're 15 and they're all on their phones and they're pointing the finger at us. And they look pretty, I don't want to say menacing, but they don't look friendly at all, you know. And as usual, you know, I'm looking around and I'm like, oh man, that doesn't look too good, you know, like we better hurry up. And one of them came and talked to us. And of course, like aggression is the best defense, you know, like that guy wasn't really chewing his word or being polite, you know, like he really wanted us out of the rooftop. And he's like, I don't even understand what you wrote. And Nov magnificently led the interaction and was like, well, I don't think it really matters that you can't read it, you know. And so the guy is taken aback. He's like, well, what you wrote, you know? And he's telling him, he's like, it don't really matter. And he's like, what do you mean? And he goes, Nov goes, well, I'm walking around, you know, and in this neighborhood, there's ownings of buildings or ownings of businesses that are written in Sanskrit. I don't personally read Sanskrit. Ownings of buildings are written in Hebrew. I don't personally read Hebrew. You guys are writing things that I don't really understand, you know? So the guy is like, oh man, he took me for a ride. And he looks at the wall and he goes, what is Know Thyself? And Nov is like, see, you can't read it. So from what started as kind of like abrasive aggression, like get the fuck out of here, the dude's guard was really way down and he was like, all right, well, Know Thyself, like I understand English and yeah, well, did you want to talk about it, you know? And we weren't really necessarily motivated to engage in a long conversation with that guy, because then it's word of mouth. We would have told him, well, we did this thing in red because we believe red is the color of love, and then he would have went and took that and maybe said, red is the color of war, we have to cover their wall, you know. So we left it like very on the surface that he was able to read what we did, we're able to paint a colorful image, and just that in itself should be positive, you know, like we're not here to sell you something, we're not here to take part of your imagination or part of your brain. We're not here to capitalize on things. We're just here to display a message and maybe start a conversation.
That's amazing, man. And honestly, a mural is so powerful. And it's something that I think that with the talent and the drive that a lot of graffiti writers have, I'm not going to say that graffiti isn't important. And I'm not going to say it doesn't change. It's changed people's lives. Sometimes it's their entire identity and introduces them to all their friends. But there are bigger things and there are bigger pictures, and one of them can be spreading a message of growth and positivity to a lot of people. And it's funny enough, last night we did a podcast with The Rescue. Mm-hmm. It hasn't come out yet, but we did an episode with The Rescue, and he was telling us about this mural project that he's working on using plays on words. For example, he writes health huge, almost like it's like bezel style, a bevel style.
Mm-hmm.
And then health, but heal is a different color than the entire health.
Mm-hmm.
And just...
lead with your heart.
Leads with your heart. I can't remember what was... Something was outlined in that, but...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's awesome to see people using these things for a greater purpose, especially when, like we already touched base on, the whole point of graph, it's like, why am I going to go write door on a mailbox if that's not me? I'm not going to get anything from it. It's almost like you're taking away what you initially got from it, or at least what was maybe your initial purpose, which was personal fame, personal ups, personal recognition, the recognition to your name. It's in case you one day stop writing that name, the idea of what you did is still existing. Whereas in this, that on the mural that you guys do, or that any person does, the mural, Once it's painted over, the idea can still exist in the minds of the people. And I was actually a few weeks ago with him. We went somewhere in Brooklyn, and I saw this mural, and it had like a paragraph on it. I started reading it, and the neighborhood, and I forget what neighborhood it was in, but it was somewhere in Brooklyn. And
it was like Bed-Stuy.
Yeah, and like the paragraph was saying something about how to liberate yourself, you first have to, like, some, it was something about like self-liberation and self-analysis and just knowing yourself and all that stuff. And I was thinking about how much more powerful that is than a throwy that says something that people really can't read. Regular people really can't read that. Even if it's the most legible throw to a graph writer, I've shown the most legible throws to certain people that don't write, just like playing, having fun and seeing if they can read it. Mm-hmm. And they really can't. It's crazy. It's really crazy. So, you know, if that dude can't read that, which he could, but if he couldn't, then, you know.
Yeah, I mean, we're three graffiti writers, or I mean, X, mm-hmm. in a way. But I want to center it back to the primal reason, you know, of graffiti, and the reason why we're drawn to it. Like, there is this gray city that's organized either as a grid or as a maze, but there's this gray city where people are passing by, going from where they're sleeping to where they're working. And the graffiti writer in the middle of that is like, wait a minute, this is not the life that I want, you know? Mm-hmm. Graffiti aims for an incredible adventure that's always, always different. Graffiti aims for a lot of fun, meeting like-minded people. Was not just to like meet up someone and be like, oh, I have a new friend in my notebook, you know? Like, it was really like, there's a meaning behind it, like building a friendship, learning yourself, learning the other. And all those different interactions are what makes graffiti completely unique and completely beautiful, you know. It happens a lot in those type of format interviews that one of the question is, you have like an anecdote or a special story about graffiti. And it's mind-boggling to me, you know, that we're all able to come up with like tons of stories, and that really reflects this sort of adventure that you're taking. Going in places where you're not supposed to, walking on train tracks at night, being in the belly of the city. Sometimes you're going to have two train tracks that are going to be on top of each other. That's going to create a bridge, and you're going to have like an internal structure to support all that. And sometimes you have three lines going over each other, and all of a sudden you're in like sort of a cathedral of architecture that, aside from a couple of workers that are covered in grease and could care less, no one has ever seen, you know. And that is that links back to the beauty and the everyday thing that we were talking about, you know, like depending on your perspective of things. If I'm on a night shift union MTA worker and they're really necessary in the city, I'm not trying to diss them or anything, you know, like you're going to walk through those lines and just carry your load and fix those bolts or this electric cable. You're not going to see any of that beauty, you know. It's like, I really want to emphasize the idea that the broader experience that we're offering with public art is in its own space, you know, and graffiti is in another space.
But I think also part of what Angel was saying, how, you know, a lot of people can't read graffiti, and maybe that's unattractive to them, but it reminds me of what Scheme said in Style Wars. He's like, it's not for people, it's for me and other graffiti writers to, you know. So there's also that aspect or way of thinking about graffiti, you know, that
completely
certain aesthetic, maybe that's a part of it, you know, and that like ruggedness, the mm-hmm. like this true subculture that's maybe not for the public, you know, it's just for that subculture, you know, to understand.
But building on that example, you know, Skim is in his kitchen with his mom next to him, and he's, I don't know, like 15 or maybe even younger, you know. And by the way, I'm going to put a small parenthesis here. I'm completely mind blown to see all the pictures that are posted by the generation of Scheme, where you see dudes that are like, they're like what I was talking about when I was 13, you know, and I was a super toy. You see like Koss posting pictures of him and his friends. They look about the same age that I was, except he's doing a fucking masterpiece with 12 different colors. I was in such a chaotic environment. Smoking joints, pushing each other, fighting, stealing markers. Like, hey, can I catch a tag with your marker? And you like jet out. You know, it's like, oh, this dude stole my marker. Like, I would have never been able to build what those guys did at the time. And I'm completely mind blown when I see the testimonies. But to go back to skiing with his mom, he's 15 and he's in the kitchen, you know, and it's there's a strong tension between the two of them. And he's really like, to go back to like the position that you take, you know, like he's a teenager. So he's like, mom, this is the way it is, you know, and I don't want to hear what you're telling me because this is my story and I'm in charge of it. And that's beautiful in itself. Like it's a way to affirm yourself and become a man or establish your personality through the vector of graffiti. But I'm sure Skeem nowadays has a total different outlook on the things, you know, just because of who he is, his life experience,
just maturity,
and exactly, and where he's at right now, you know. And it's beautiful. There's room for the Skeem of 15. Thank God we still have trains that are painted almost on a daily basis. And there's room for the more mature, maybe father, 50-year-old, you know, who's like, hey, I want to do galleries and I want to do murals and all that.
Absolutely, man. Yo, thank you for coming, man.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Really, it was a pleasure.
Thank you.
Peace.
Peace.